Hi, so thanks everybody for making the trek to get out here this morning. I'm Tyson Howell. I work in George Jepkowski's lab. I'm working on my PhD there. And today I'm going to be talking about my project using canopy spectral reflectance for mapping a drought resistance trait from a translocation of the right chromosome arm into common wheat. So I'd like to start with just a basic overview of cereal genetics. This might not be necessary here, so I'll try to go through it pretty quickly. We have bread wheat is a hexaploid. It's got three different genomes, the A, B, and the D. We also have pasta wheat, has just the A and the B genomes. And a close relative of these is rye. And this grows in a lot of very non-optimal conditions. And it's very hardy. And there's been a new species that was generated called triticale. Most of you probably know what this is, but it's a very robust crop. In California, it pretty much always out-yields wheat. It's got a lot of disease resistance and abiotic stress tolerances, but the problem with it is it's not wheat, so we can't really make bread with it or anything. One of the things that's been done to try and capture some of the benefits of triticale without having the problems of quality is using a translocation. So there's a translocation of the short arm of chromosome 1 from rye, which has been put into bread wheat onto the 1B chromosome arm. It's called the 1RS-1BL translocation, and pretty much everything I'm going to be talking about in this talk is going to be referring to this translocation here. So where this story starts is in our breeding program, we had two varieties that were from Simmet. They were cultivars Attila and Han. Both of these had the 1RS-1BL translocation. They were both very high-yielding lines, but we couldn't really use them in our breeding program because they had poor bread-making quality, and this has been known to be associated with the 1RS translocation for quite some time. To address this problem, one of our collaborators, Adam Lukaszewski at UC Riverside, engineered a recombinant 1RS-1BS chromosome arm, which I'm going to be referring to as the 1RS-WW arm, to kind of fix some of these quality problems. So we took this arm that he generated, and we backcrossed it into these two varieties with six backcrosses to generate some neoestrogenic lines. And this is just kind of visually showing what was done here. So up here on the top, we have rye is in... So rye is in red here, and wheat is in yellow. This is the new chromosome arm that he engineered. So there were two regions on 1RS that have been implicated in bread-making quality problems. One of them is that rye has the SEC1 locus, which encodes the SEC-alenes, which are some rye seed storage proteins. They make the dough really sticky and hard to work with. The other is that rye is actually missing the GluB3, GluB1 loci, which are important for gluten strength. So lines with the 1RS translocation also have weak gluten. On the 1BS arm, there's obviously no SEC-alenes since those are rye proteins, and we have the GluB3, GluB1 loci are present. So what he did is he basically just changed both of those regions out. So he eliminated the sticky dough problem and reinstituted these loci to try and fix the gluten strength. So in 2009, we had our back crosses done. We planted these in the field to look at them. We were just hoping to see that we'd have some improved quality. But we had a really dry spring. There was no rain and no irrigation from March to April for a whole month. And we went out and looked at the plant. And I don't know if you can really see it here, but all of the lines that had the 1RS chromosome, they looked like they were doing pretty well. They looked happy, even though they had not had water for a while. But when we looked at the lines that had this engineered chromosome arm, they looked like they were not performing very well at all in the field. They had a lot of dried flag leaves. All the leaves were really rolled, and they just did not, they were not doing well out there. We eventually got some rain, and the 1RS lines recovered pretty well. But the 1RS-WW lines that had this, the improved quality, did not recover. So this started getting us thinking, maybe this is something related to drought. This is what the yield looked like from that year. So we have the two varieties here. Attila is in blue and Han is in green. And you can see on the left here, these are the neoestrogenic lines that contain the complete 1RS chromosome arm. So these were the original varieties. And on the right here are the ones where we introgressed this recombinant chromosome arm. We had a huge drop in yield. So for the Attila variety, we had a 25% yield drop. And in the Han variety, we had a 41% yield reduction. So there was clearly something other than just quality traits that was in these two regions here. So the first thing we wanted to do is we wanted to genotype these, make sure they were actually isogenic. So we used the 90K SNP chip, which we developed in the TGAP project, and we had 31,500 markers that were scored on the in the genome of the 1RS WW donor and also in our two lines that we backcrossed this into. We excluded the markers on the 1BS arm because we were expecting those to be polymorphic because we had replaced that with the 1RS arm. And after backcrossing, in the Attila variety, we had 40 SNPs between the 1RS and the 1RS WW near isogenic lines, so 0.6% polymorphism. So these were very highly isogenic. And in the Han background, which, if you remember from the last slide, was the more sensitive background, we only had one SNP between our two isogenic lines. So it looked like we had done a really good job of cleaning up the background here. And as I said, both these lines were highly isogenic with the exception of those two chromosome arms. So moving forward, we knew that we had lost something important with this 1RS WW translocation just due to that yield difference. During the intermittent drought, we saw large differences in yield. After the rain, the 1RS lines recovered, but the 1RS WW lines did not recover. So moving forward, we wanted to try and look a little bit at drought traits here. So we wanted to see how can we look at how the plants are responding to water. And one of the things we came up with was canopy spectroreflectance. So canopy spectroreflectance measures the intensity of different wavelengths of light on the electromagnetic spectrum. Basically, it's just kind of looking at the plants. As humans, we can only see a small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. So this is all visible light here, and it's in just this little, this little sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum here. So using canopy spectroreflectance, we can look at a much broader range of light wavelengths than we can with our eyes. And some of the common things that people use canopy spectroreflectance for are measuring things like the amount of water, which is what we mainly focus on, or a more common one is chlorophyll. So these absorb light at different wavelengths. And based on this, we can estimate how much water or how much chlorophyll is in the area that we're looking at. We used two different spectrometers for our project. We started out using the JAZ spectrometer from Ocean Optics. It had a range from about 500 to 1,000 nanometers that we could look at. And we eventually moved on and started using the handheld 2 from ASD, which has a much broader spectrum. It was also a little bit easier to use in the field. It's just kind of a brief overview of how CSR works. For us, we're using the sun as our light source. So the light's going to come. It's going to go through the atmosphere. Some of it's going to get absorbed, diffused, reflected. But eventually, it's going to make it to our target, which in our case is the plant canopy. So our plants are going to be absorbing a lot of that light, doing photosynthesis, but also pigments and other things are going to be absorbing light. Whatever's not absorbed is going to be reflected. There can be some diffusion and scattering. This isn't too much of a problem for us since we're using ground-based canopy spectroreflectance. It's more of a problem if you're using something like a satellite. But eventually, the light reflected from the canopy is going to reach our fiber optic cable. That's going to go into our spectrometer, and it's going to be diffused by something called a grating. It does the same thing as a prism. It's going to split that beam of light into its component wavelengths, and those are going to go onto different sensors, and that's how we know what intensity of light we have at each different wavelength. And this is what the values we're actually getting back from our spectrometer. So some practical considerations for doing canopy spectroreflectance. It's very important that you have a good white reference. This is basically setting what 100% reflectance is for all of the wavelengths that you're looking at. And we used two different ones. We started out using a mixture of barium sulfate and paint, just painted onto a board. And we did get some pretty good results with that. And we eventually moved on and started using Spectralon. This is much more expensive, but it does have much better reflectance properties. Something like 99.9% reflectance for a very broad range of wavelengths. Because something that we look at and say is white may not actually look white in other wavelengths that are not visible light. So we use two measurement methods. When we started out, we were using a subsampling method. So we took three spots per plot, and at each of these spots, we were taking several averages. I believe we were taking 30 averages at each of these. So we had 90 measurements per plot. We would average all of those together, and then that would be the value that we would use for analyzing our plot. We, after looking at the data from this first year, we found there was quite a bit of variability between those spots. So we moved to a scanning method where we set the spectrometer to take a large number of averages. We would start measuring at one end of the plot, and just as it was taking these different measurements, we would move along the plot, and when we got to the end, we would stop the measurement, and this would just give us one value for the plot, and it was actually much more reproducible than making the point measurements like we were doing before. And then once we get back to the lab, we applied a spectral smoothing. It's called boxcar smoothing. So basically we took our wavelength of interest and we took the five nearest points on either side of that and averaged all those together to basically just try and average out some of the noise that we get from the spectrometers, especially with the higher resolution ones like the JAS. And after we've done this, we can calculate our indices. The main one that we're using is NWI3. And as I mentioned earlier, at 970 nanometers, this is where water absorbs. This is the wavelength, one of the wavelengths that water absorbs. And this 880 nanometers, that's the other value in this equation here, is basically just to correct for differences in canopy structure. It has nothing to do with water. It just helps it be a little bit more consistent. So on this slide, I want to draw your attention to this second graph down here. This is the canopy water status, and I'd like to point out that NWI3 is a negative index, so the more negative these values are, this means that these plots have more water in them. And we see something, so we have both varieties here. We have Attila and Han, and this year we've actually been able to apply an irrigation treatment. So in the Attila background, we see that, first of all, the differences are not as big as they are in the Han background. And which is what we saw with the yield earlier. And we can see that when we do look in the Han background, we see differences both in normal irrigation and low irrigation, but the differences are much bigger under low irrigation conditions. We also measured carbon isotope discrimination. I'll talk more about this later, but what I want you to look at for now is that all of the 1RS lines, which are these red bars here, the yellow ones are going to be the 1RS WW containing isogenic lines. All of these 1RS lines have higher carbon isotope discrimination. And once again, as we see with yield, the difference is bigger in the Han variety than it is in Attila. And our CSR results largely agreed with these other measurements that we had. It actually seemed like it was doing a better job of picking up the differences. It looked like it was more sensitive. And this is because it's a point measurement. So we can actually take this measurement when the plants are feeling the stress in the field, whereas something like yield or carbon isotope discrimination is kind of integrated over the entire growing season of the plant. And we can also make multiple canopy spectral reflectance measurements throughout the season. So now that we knew there was something going on here, we were convinced it was not something in the background, we wanted to find out what region of this new chromosome arm, this 1RS WW chromosome arm, was important in this. So we crossed the 1RS and the 1RS WW arms together, and we generated two new ones that had only the proximal or only the distal wheat segments. And the first year, when we grew these in the field, we had made these crosses in the greenhouse. We didn't have very many seeds. We had different numbers of seeds for different genotypes. So doing a yield trial was completely out of the question. We just kind of planted them in the field to do a seed increase, but we said, hey, why don't we take our spectrometer, go out there, and see if we can see any differences. And we actually did see very good differences. So this red and pink bar here are the 1RS and the 1RS WR. So this is the one that has the proximal wheat segment, but both of these are have rye in the distal segment, and the yellow and the white have wheat in the distal segment. And you can see here that the 1RS and the 1RSWR lines are grouping together, and the lines that have wheat in the distal segment are grouping with each other. We saw this on, I just have two dates on here, but as you can see, these were pretty good results, much better than we were kind of expecting to see based on the number of plants we had out there. We did this again the next year when we had actual full plots, and basically we see the same thing again. We see that the 1RS genotype is grouping with the 1RSWR genotype, so when you have rye in the distal region, you're performing pretty well in the field, and when you have wheat in the distal region, you're not performing as well. And we're seeing this both in the normal irrigation and the low irrigation conditions. We're seeing this for yield, we're seeing this for CSR, and again, we're seeing this for carbon isotope discrimination. So we wanted to know a little bit about why these 1RS lines were performing better in the field. And the way we went about answering that question is by looking at the carbon isotope discrimination. So I was going to talk a little bit about what goes into this. I'm going to skip it just in the interest of time. But basically the takeaway is that carbon isotope discrimination is determined by two things. The first is photosynthetic rate. So if a plant, all other things being equal, if you have two plants and one plant has a higher photosynthetic rate than the other, it's going to have a lower carbon isotope discrimination. And the other factor is stomatal conductance. So if you have two plants, all other things being equal, one has higher stomatal conductance than the other, the one with higher stomatal conductance will have a higher carbon isotope discrimination ratio. So what we see in our plants is that there are no differences between our four genotypes for photosynthetic capacity. They all look pretty much the same. There are no significant differences between them. But then when we look at stomatal conductance, we see that these two lines that have rye in this distal region are grouping together, and the two lines that have wheat in the distal region are grouping together again. And these ones have a significantly lower stomatal conductance than the 1RS type lines. So this implies, or it suggests that the 1RS and the 1RSW line, WR lines actually have access to more water over the growing season, and this is kind of backed up by what we're seeing with the plants having better canopy water status. And so in summary, the lines with rye chromatin in the distal segment have much better field performance than those that have wheat in the distal region. So this is the critical region for this trait that we're looking at. There is an effective genetic background, but I'd like to note that there's never a penalty for having the 1RS type in this distal region. The only effective genetic background is on the magnitude of yield loss that you get for having wheat in this distal region here. The 1RS performs better than the 1RSWW and the 1RSRW, so better than these two lines, under both normal and low irrigation conditions. So there's no penalty for having this translocation under optimal conditions, whereas a lot of times when we're looking at something that's more water use efficient or more drought resistant, we see that it doesn't perform as well under optimal conditions because it's a conservative genotype. But we're not seeing that with this one. And as I went over, drought resistance does map to the distal region, so this means we can remove this SEC1 locus, which encodes for these sequelins, without any penalty on yield. But unfortunately, we can't separate the GluB3, GluB1 loci, which are important for gluten strength, from this drought resistance QTL that we have here. And kind of another takeaway from this, using CSR to estimate canopy water status was effective, even when we had a very small number of plants. So a lot of times you'll hear people using canopy spectral reflectance for high throughput. We found that it also has use at lower throughput when you're constrained on the number of plants that you can actually put in the field. And you can also get a little bit better sensitivity with CSR than you can with yield or carbon isotope discrimination because this is a point measurement, because you can measure the plants when they're feeling the most stressed and it's not integrated over the entire growing season. Some current things that we're working on. Currently generating a chromosome where we're combining just this distal 1RS segment, and we're combining it with some other genes to try and rescue the gluten strength, since we can't separate our drought resistance from the gluten strength alleles. So we're combining it with this BX7 overexpressed allele, which is basically just an overexpressed version of a gluten gene. And some studies in Argentine wheats have shown that this allele can restore gluten strength in 1RS-containing lines. So we're hopeful that we'll have something with good quality here. We're currently introgressing this into several different varieties. And one of the benefits of using this strategy is that we've freed up the 1BS arm for recombination again, so we can use this in breeding. We have some other genes that are on here for disease resistance that we'd like to, that we've put in here as well. But one possible drawback with this is that we don't know whether this distal rye segment is interacting with something closer to the central mirror on the 1RS arm, just because we haven't grown it, but we should find that soon enough when we're growing these out in the field. A couple other things we're doing, we're comparing sequences between the 1RS and the 1RS RW lines, or chromosome arms, to see what's in that distal region there, what's different between these. We're generating a mutant population to try and do a little bit more mapping on this. We're working with Adam Lukaszewski to generate some additional 1RS, 1BS recombinants. The reason we're not just going for recombinants is that recombination is blocked between the rye and the wheat genomes. So it's very difficult to get these recombinations. When Adam made this initial chromosome arm, he screened over 20,000 plants, and he recovered only 103 recombinants between these two arms. So that's why we're going with the mutant population as well. And ultimately, we would like to clone the responsible gene or genes that is causing this effect so that we can kind of get our foot in the door for drought resistance and yield pathways in wheat. I'd like to thank a few people. Obviously, I'd like to thank George for all of his support and advice in this project and having me in his lab. Adam Lukaszewski has been a great collaborator in this. Iago and Lucio worked on this project a little bit before I joined the lab. Josh and Oswaldo helped out with a lot of the field stuff. Matthew Gilbert helped with the physiology, so looking at the carbon isotope discrimination, photosynthetic rate, and interpreting all of that. Marcos Bonafede, he helped us with a lot of the backcrossing of that 1RSWW chromosome arm. I'd like to thank TCAP, obviously, for making this all possible, and my student Andrew Winters. And also, HHMI helped us buy one of the spectrometers that we were using. And UC Davis Plant Sciences for helping fund me and everything. So, thank you for listening.
All right, well, we do have time for a question or two.
Yeah.
So, when you were using your spectrometer, you could detect that there was water in the canopy?
Yeah, so water actually. Yeah.
And when you did carbon isotope discrimination, you saw a difference?
Yes.
So, what were you using? What were you measuring?
Grain, at the mature grain, yeah. At the end of the season.
These are great, yeah. I was just trying to think of how you tie those two results together.
Mm-hmm.
So if your plants are open, you have more water, if your plants are open, you change your results.
Yeah. Basically, I was trying to hurry up a little bit because we started late, but
I wasn't sure when you were measuring or what you were measuring.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, so yield and carbon isotope discrimination, we're measuring both of those on the grain at the end of the season, so they're integrated measurements over the whole season, whereas canopy structure reflectance, we can measure it when the plants were actually feeling the stress, so we could get a little bit more sensitivity there.
I was wondering if you measured it earlier on plants that weren't stressed, if you would see a difference or not, if that reflected on the surface of water saving strategy, that's why they had to show things over.
Yeah, we didn't look at that, but that is one thing. Yeah, that was kind of our conclusion there. Because of the carbon isotope discrimination and that somato conductance and photosynthetic rate information that we have, basically the 1RS lines are keeping their somato more open during the growing season. So they must be pulling up more water, because if they didn't have access to more water, they would be dead.
Yes. Would that have any downstream consequences on the cropping system?
It could possibly. I mean, if they're mining more water out of the soil, it could have implications for what you're planting after that. But we haven't looked at that yet.
Some translocation's been reported to affect root growth, so are you...
Yeah. Yes, we're trying to look at roots. Like George said, they're very difficult to work with. We have done some things. We're trying to grow them in tubes and everything, but a lot of times when we grow these things in the greenhouse, we don't see what we see in the field. And if you're growing them in the field, it's extremely, extremely difficult to actually get at the roots unless you've got like giant tractors. And
when things reach down, there's still roots.
Yeah.
And then, you know, North Carolina,
yeah, so it is. We are trying to look at roots. It's very difficult, though.
One more quick question.
Yeah.
I just want to know under which conditions you measure the canopy reflectivity or reliable.
So most of these were made after heading and flowering. So these were kind of towards the end of the season before the plant started senescing. I think most of these were taken in April or May. But this was after it had been dry for quite some time, and we could actually, with our eyes, see some of the stress for the plants. We could start to see leaves rolling in some of them. We like the handheld 2 from ASD a little bit better. It's a lot easier to use because of the sensor technology. It's got a little bit less noise. The resolution isn't as good for the different spectral wavelengths, but we did like that one a lot more. And it's much easier to take references as you're out there, which can really help improve kind of the quality of your data. If you're not taking your white reference very often, it can really affect things out there in the field.
All right. Well, thank you very much, guys.
All right. Thank you.